From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. John McNamee is a priest who has lived and worked in Philadelphia's poorest neighborhoods for over 25 years. What he's seen there has sometimes made him doubt his faith. On today's Fresh Air, Father McNamee tells us how he's learned to live with his doubts. Also today, we meet first-time novelist and ABC Productions Vice President of Comedy, Eugene Stein. His semi-autobiographical novel, Straitjacket and Tie, is about a young man dealing with his increasingly disoriented schizophrenic brother. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new compilation album pairing country singers and soul singers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A leading Midwest bank has raised its prime lending rate 0.25% to 6.25%. That's the first increase in the prime since July 1992. The action's been taken by Norwest Corporation of Minneapolis. This comes after the Federal Reserve acted to raise short-term interest rates for the second time this year. The prime rate is a base lending rate used by banks to determine a range of other consumer loans, like credit card loans and personal loans. First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton has traveled to Capitol Hill again to promote the administration's health care reform plan. She also heard from elderly Americans who are coping with long-term illnesses. UPI's Carol Van Dam has this report.
The First Lady listened intently as one senior citizen after another gave testimony as to how harsh the current system can be for people caring for loved ones at home suffering from chronic illnesses. Mrs. Clinton says the president's approach to health care is really quite simple.
It is to guarantee private health insurance to every American that can never be taken away, can never be changed, can never be cut, can never be reduced, can never be snatched away when needed most.
Most competing plans circulating on Capitol Hill agree on that point, but divide on how the plan should be paid for. Carol Van Dam, Capitol Hill.
South African election officials met with Inkatha Freedom Party leader Mangosuthu Buthelezi today. Buthelezi is leading his party in boycotting next month's all-race elections. The Inkatha chief also controls the KwaZulu homeland, and he's only given vague assurances that he'll allow free and fair voting in his region. NPR's Michael Scholar reports.
It's getting ugly in Natal. Inkatha opposes the elections and claims that its political rival, the African National Congress, is trying to start a people's revolt to bring down the KwaZulu government led by Buthelezi. The ANC insists that Inkatha is stirring up violence, which has killed dozens over the last few days, in order to ruin the elections. The conflict will likely worsen in the coming days as the ANC holds mass demonstrations in Natal in support of the elections. Meanwhile, the multi-party council, which is governing South Africa, is facing a tough choice. Does it send in troops now to ensure a free election in KwaZulu, a move Inkatha says will be violently opposed, or does it keep trying to negotiate with Buthelezi and risk violence and an unfair vote on election day? Either way, few think bloodshed can be avoided in Natal as the election approaches. This is Michael Scholar in Johannesburg.
The government says orders for durable goods fell 2.5% in February. The unexpectedly large drop was led by fewer orders for defense items and aircraft. But the Commerce Department says if orders for transportation were left out, durable goods orders would be unchanged from January. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 8 points at 3870. This is NPR. Russian officials say there was one American passenger on the Russian jetliner that crashed today in Siberia. The Aeroflot plane was going from Moscow to Hong Kong when it crashed into a remote forest near the Mongolian border and blew up. There were no survivors among the 75 people aboard. Air traffic controllers say the plane disappeared from radar screens just after a routine radio check, and the pilots didn't report any problems. Authorities don't know what caused the crash. The government has released its final regulations on labeling meat and poultry. Companies now have 60 days to label their raw meat and poultry products. NPR's Laura Kanoy reports.
The label tells consumers that some food products may contain bacteria that could make them sick, and it gives basic information about proper handling, cooking, and storing of raw meat and poultry. The advice includes: keep it refrigerated or frozen, and thaw in the refrigerator or microwave. Wash utensils and hands after touching raw meat, and keep it separate from other foods. Cook thoroughly and refrigerate leftovers immediately. Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy called the labels essential to the health and safety of consumers. Espy came into office during last year's E. coli outbreak in the Pacific Northwest, traced to undercooked contaminated hamburger. Espy has vowed to clean up the nation's meat and poultry inspection system, and he said the new meat label will not affect his department's responsibility to make improvements. This is Laura Kanoy in Washington.
Jury selection continues in a civil suit brought by Rodney King against the city of Los Angeles. The trial will determine if the city should pay damages to King for the beating he suffered at the hands of city police 3 years ago. King's attorney says his client is asking for less money, but he won't say how much. Any settlement would only determine what L.A. will pay King for his physical injuries. Another trial would still be held to determine if former police officers must pay King punitive damages. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Priests listen to people's troubles. It is more infrequent that we are privy to the doubts of priests. Father John McNamee shares many of his doubts in his memoir, Diary of a City Priest, a journal of 1 year at St. Malachy's in North Philadelphia. It's an inner-city neighborhood where he says people have nothing, nothing works, and mayhem is frequent. Although he feels he serves an important role in the community, he knows that he is also something of an outsider. A white man in an African-American neighborhood, a priest in a neighborhood of few Catholics. Father McNamee is now 60. He was ordained in 1959. Before we talk, I want you to hear an excerpt of his book, Diary of a City Priest. This entry is from a winter day when he sought comfort at the Academy of Music, where the Philadelphia Orchestra was performing works by Vivaldi and Prokofiev. But he was distracted by his thoughts.
Why can I not simply be here, enjoy the music? Allow it to refresh me, to help me believe more easily for this while, if I can. Or why do I need to believe anything at all? I sense people are not so distracted. Perhaps life makes sense, perhaps not. In either case, the music is able to be enjoyed, and we have to live on, meaning or no meaning. Perhaps being a priest is the problem. Tomorrow is Sunday, and people will come to church, and I shall have to say something to them that makes sense to myself as well as them. Perhaps being a priest is so connected with life having some meaning that the modern world threatens me. I suspect a conspiracy of silence out there. People are courteous to us priests, not telling us that they cannot and need not and do not believe any more everything or anything that we stand for. What do I do with my doubt? Spend more time listening to Vivaldi? Let the doubt paralyze? Exercise faith like some muscle that improves with workouts? Perhaps this holding on with fragile grasp is the human condition, something I should endure more patiently and calmly. Even Paul said we only see dimly as in a dark mirror. And Simone Weil and also John of the Cross, I suspect, say that God is more like nothing than any of our images. One response that I do not want in myself is to run with some excess, proclaiming the social relevance of faith. I fear that is what is happening in Catholic colleges, where often enough any traditional doctrinal courses are simply not available and theology or whatever becomes exposure to the teacher's agenda of social concerns. I think that Dorothy Day would have believed everything she did, even if the world did not need her spiritual or corporal works of mercy.
That's Father John McNamee reading from his memoir, Diary of a City Priest. Now, I'm wondering what you do with your doubts if you feel that you should protect other people from your doubts, because we usually think of it as the priest's role to strengthen people's faith, not to strengthen their doubts.
Well, I think maybe somewhere else in the book, I talk about how much I learned from Graham Greene, the novelist, who was a Catholic. And he accepted doubt as part of the human condition. And he said, it's human to doubt. and it makes one hold on more firmly because one is more aware of one's precarious stance. And so that I think I've learned, as I didn't know when I was younger, I think I have learned to live with doubt as expression of the human condition. And again, it's a very, very real way of being in my neighborhood where people live with such uncertainty. Their uncertainties are financial, familial, relational, the precariousness of marriages under such stress and strain. And so I say, well, the gospel says, blessed are the poor in spirit. So if even I experience my faith as a poor kind of holding on, well, then maybe that's the best kind of faith, one that is sort of precarious and tentative. And maybe if people learn to accept their doubts and believe anyhow, there's a... My training would have been in the scholastic tradition in which faith is a gift. It is grace informing the will to accept what is not intellectually self-evident.
In the passage that you read, you basically expressed your distrust for people who proclaim the social relevance of their faith. That when you have doubts, you're not going to turn to the social relevance of your faith as a way to hold on to it. Why not?
I would want social relevance or social concern to flow from faith, but I would want it to be firmly rooted in faith. And I wouldn't want to substitute social relevance for faith and say religion is worthwhile because of all the good it does. It has to be kind of worthwhile in itself. You know?
In your diary, you write, "Here among the poor, the seeming irrelevance of Christ is most visible." What do you mean by that?
The religious sensibility is a refined sensibility. It requires a kind of a leisure, a kind of a reflection that is tragically so often unavailable to the poor who are busy coping, you know, and so... I guess the image of what I'm doing or what I would like to be doing at best or in the deepest religious sense would be to sort of make myself and the people around the neighborhood more aware of the divine love in which I believe we all live, they and I as well, like fish in water, the love which Dante says, the love that moves the sun and the other stars, you know?
Yet it seems from your memoir that you're always dealing with your own doubts and always questioning your faith. I mean, in fact, and there's one episode in your memoir that I found very moving, really. You go to visit a mother who you know, whose son has been murdered, and friends and relatives are there. And they're all saying, it's only God that's going to get us through this. It's only our faith that will get us through this. And you're thinking about all the doubts that you have about faith.
There is a dimension of reflection that once it begins by way of philosophical exploration of the meaning of life, that is a very dark journey. And I think maybe part of what I'm saying when I look at these women who are, you know, more coping than I am, and they sort of are less critical of the ordinary answers, I kind of look at them with kind of perhaps an envy. I do realize that my education, my Irish, perhaps my bleak Irish spirit, some people sometimes accuse me of having a rather bleak Irish spirit. And, you know, Yeats warned against what he called the Celtic twilight, that madness that whereby one sees life very unadorned, you know. My friend Robert McGovern, the artist, is very fond of these stark Irish images of, say, a blackbird pecking at a human corpse or something like that, you know, the unadorned human truth. And again, it's Simone Weil. Simone Weil said that... Simone Weil or Weil, she said that the way that one should proceed intellectually and maybe even religiously was to take, say, a religious statement, to take it at its farthest possible extreme and see if it's still true. For example, one of the phrases we sometimes sing in church is a biblical phrase from the Psalms, "The Lord hears the cry of the poor." And I'm sitting there celebrating the Mass, and after the first reading, a cantor invites the people to sing that response and the verses of the psalm. And I'm sitting there saying, I wonder what that means. The Lord hears the cry of the poor. Nothing sings further from the truth. What seems true is the awful silence of God, the mystery that we call God in the face of human suffering. What does it mean to sing this biblical phrase, the Lord hears the cry of the poor? And so then one has to explore more deeply what it might mean. And one, if one is a believer, one say, well, it must mean something, and I think I'll try to find out more deeply what it means, since it doesn't mean what it obviously might mean.
My guest is Father John McNamee, author of the memoir Diary of a City Priest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Father John McNamee. In your book, you write about people coming to the church and asking for things and asking for money, and how sometimes, like around Christmas, people who have like no need for the church at all during the rest of the year and who are hanging out in front of liquor stores or something are suddenly knocking at the door looking for help. And I wonder how you react to that, if you try to be very discriminating about who gets the favors or who gets the money and who really needs it or who's just there to hustle. Or if you feel that everybody is in fact truly in need there, whether they're using a hustle to get what they need or not.
Well, what comes to mind in considering that question of yours is a little scenario from My Fair Lady, if you remember the play and the movie with Audrey Hepburn and Rex Harrison.
Yeah.
And whenever Dr. Iggins, Rex Harrison, takes Liza Doolittle into his care in order to teach her to speak so that she can get rid of her Cockney accent and become a elegant speaking English woman, her father, this sort of hustler down in Covent Garden, he hears that his daughter, Liza Doolittle, has taken up with a fancy professor, and he goes around to see Henry Iggins. And he sort of suggests that he should have a piece of the action because, after all, she is his daughter and he should be compensated as well. Well, proper Henry Iggins is so appalled at this, he says to him, "My goodness, man, I don't believe this," he says. "You think that I've taken up with your daughter in an improper way, and not only you're not scandalized, but that you want to profit from this? And have you no morals, sir?" And Liza Doolittle's father says, "Can't afford them, Governor," you know, as though he is coping and surviving and hustling, and he doesn't have the time to the luxury of the moral reflection. And so that really doesn't bother me, people coming to me and in various stages of need and hustle and whatever. And I even have some scriptural images from the New Testament that help me. The Jesus sayings, "Don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. You have received freely, freely give. If someone wants your coat, give him your shirt as well. If someone wants you to walk a mile on the road, go 2 miles. Give to everyone who asks of you." As Father Dan Berrigan says, it's almost an invitation to be with and for others in ways that the authorities would call irresponsible.
You quote Simone Weil a lot in your book. And you quote her as saying that the charitable exchange, that is real charity or real love, is more rare a miracle than walking on water. And you talk in your book about how when one person gives money or clothes or something to another person, it often reinforces their mutual positions of somebody being humiliated and somebody doing the humiliating. Obviously, this is not the relationship that you want. So in the position of being the person who is always trying to give, how do you try to make it a true act of charity and not an act that reinforces the humiliation of receiving?
Well, I have a couple of other little pithy sayings that I sometimes use. I think they're from people like Gilbert Keith Chesterton, who said, if something's worth doing, it's worth doing poorly. That's the best you can manage, you know? Or perhaps more seriously, the enemy of the good is the best.
Oh, right. Right. If you're looking for perfection, it'll just lead you to inaction.
And sometimes, I guess what made me say that from Simone Weil, sometimes I have noticed in observing my own emotions when I am called to the door once again and one of these guys is there smelling up the foyer and, you know, and I know he's got a few drinks in him. I mean, I have absolutely observed myself giving the fellow the $3 to get rid of him. It was the easiest way to discharge this interaction, you know, was here. Now go and get out and don't come back or don't come back soon anyhow. So that you observe yourself. And sometimes, you know, when you're on edge with it, when, you know, it's the 15th one today and you're on the edge of your patience with it all, you communicate that to the other fellow. And you can actually observe him absorbing this humiliation because he wants the dollars or the food or whatever. And even as you're doing it, you feel bad for not doing it better.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of crime and vandalism in the neighborhood that you're in.
Yes.
And the church isn't exempted from that. You've had a lot of kids throwing rocks at the windows, breaking the windows at the church, mm-hmm. things stolen from the church. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how that makes you feel, if you feel that somehow the church should be protected from that, that the church is a sanctuary, that there should be respect for the religion and the church, even if it's not the religion of a person in the mm-hmm. neighborhood, they should mm-hmm. respect the institution. Or if you just feel, well, you know, it's a building like any other.
I think I sort of understand that kind of random violence or vandalism of a poor neighborhood having about the same moral character as graffiti.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't think it's so much an expression of wickedness as an expression of frustration or, you know, kind of futility. And I don't take it personal, as we say. And I'm always mindful that if we suffer this kind of harassment in the neighborhood, it's a very authentic way of being there because that's what everybody else suffers in those neighborhoods. And I wouldn't really want to be there like some god on Mount Olympus reaching down to help these mortals in their troubled lives as though my life among them were going to be intact and self-sufficient and impervious to all of that kind of harassment that is part of the life of the poor.
You write poetry.
I do, yes.
And I have a poem here that you wrote that I'd like you to read. Your father was born in Ireland, and you sometimes go to Ireland to get away, to reflect. And I believe this is a poem you wrote either in Ireland or...
Yes, I did write it in Ireland, yes.
Okay.
And I was staying with a wonderful Franciscan priest friend. I was even making a retreat with him. A retreat is a time, what the Quakers would call a quiet time.
Mm-hmm.
And on the beach there are these Martello Towers, which are very prominent in the writings of James Joyce, you know, that tortured Catholic sensibility who wrote Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake and the Dubliners and so much else. But anyhow, that area is called Sandy Mount. And I'm walking on that beach, and I see a sign, and that occasioned the poem. Sandy Mount. The black wash of Dublin Bay, and in the wet sand a sign, whoever wanders 200 meters here risk fierce incoming tides. James Joyce walked here. Risk tides, went away on eagle's wings. I cautious, stay safe, walk carefully, return at last to the familiar. Kept man of the domestic church, secure, I seek further the comfort of these surroundings, chapel, sacrament, books, road maps for my rough within. My steps are measured, never beyond easy return. My hope is hinged on the promise that timid sparrows are as watched as eagles.
Reading that poem led me to wonder if you see your life as a priest as being a sign of timidity, because it almost seems from the poem that you're seeing your place within the church as being out of a need for security, and maybe an expression of timidity, although it seems to me that you've taken on so many challenges as a priest, and that it's really been more of an adventure than a safe enclave.
Yes, I think as I read the poem now, at your request, I sense two things. First of all, some of the other choices that I might have made in terms of being a priest, I could have gone to that Trappist monastery, which would have been sort of a big dive, like one of those divers off those cliffs in Mexico into the surging sea, you know? Or on the other hand, there was always the fascination with the foreign missions, as we called them then, especially the Maryknoll priests. I remember when I was a boy, they were many pictures of them standing in the middle of a rice field in Manchuria with their cassocks blowing in the wind. And I didn't make those choices. And so this domestic scene seems fairly safe by comparison. Although I guess we've become more aware in recent times that the local landscape is anything but safe either, or without adventure or risk. And maybe still another dimension of the poem in which I talk about Joyce being bravado, Joyce's mm-hmm. bravado and my timidity, has to do with the sense of sometimes feeling that this society of ours is profoundly unreal over against the rest of the world, the kinds of things that occupy us, the kinds of things that concern us, and even the political agenda or the social agenda, you know. And so sometimes I think, what am I doing living in this society? I mean, I think I really would have a harder time living in, say, a suburban parish where people were asking me to help them with programs for marriage enrichment. And maybe one of the reasons I am in North Philadelphia is the idea not to be so secure and to live in a society that is so unreal.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Father John McNamee is the author of Diary of a City Priest, published by Sheed and Ward. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Eugene Stein develops comedy shows for ABC TV, and he's written for such shows as Cheers and Murphy Brown. His new novel is an often comic look at a devastating experience, growing up with a schizophrenic brother. Coming up, we'll talk about the experiences the novel's based on. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Rhythm, Country, and Blues, a new album teaming up soul and country performers. Al Green is paired with Lyle Lovett, Little Richard with Tanya Tucker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The United States and North Korea are trading accusations over North Korea's refusal to let inspectors fully check out its suspect nuclear sites. They're taking care, however, to leave room for diplomacy. Barry Schwide reports the situation is similar to the Korean War.
The U.S. is speaking again of defending South Korea, and Patriot missiles have been ordered sent to South Korea. The North Koreans, meanwhile, are accusing the U.S. of pushing the situation to the brink of war. As fearsome as the rhetoric is getting, though, it is designed to reinforce diplomacy. The North Koreans want to make it clear they intend to set their own rules for international inspection. The U.S., meanwhile, has not given up its diplomacy, not so much with North Korea, but with China and Japan. They share U.S. concern that North Korea may be developing nuclear weapons, but they're also concerned the tensions could ignite a conflict. So the Clinton administration is moving very slowly and hoping the rhetoric will persuade North Korea to yield and persuade China and Japan that every diplomatic effort is being made. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
Bosnian Serb leaders are talking about some possible concessions to the Bosnian government and Bosnian Croats. The Serbs have opened a two-day session to discuss how much territory they might yield to a Bosnian government-Croat federation. They're also talking about what, if any, ties should be created with it. The Serbs hold 72% of Bosnian territory. The U.S. Department of Education is reviewing Ohio's ninth-grade proficiency test. It wants to see if the test violates the civil rights of minority students. Mary Garrity of member station WCPN reports from Cleveland.
About half the states in the U.S. require students to pass standardized tests before graduating, but Ohio's is the first to be examined by a federal agency. It's being investigated at the request of the Cleveland NAACP, which says minority students in Ohio haven't had a fair opportunity to pass the exam. They charge that the students have attended schools with inferior curriculums and lower standards. Federal officials say if they find a disproportionate number of minorities have failed the exam and been denied a diploma, it would be a serious civil rights issue, which could result in a moratorium on the test and the withholding of federal money. In Cleveland, about 40% of black seniors and 24% of white seniors still need to pass the exam. For National Public Radio, this is Mary Garrity in Cleveland.
Senior congressional leaders say they want to be very careful with Whitewater hearings. The House has voted to follow the Senate's lead and hold hearings. Details have yet to be worked out. Republican Congressman Jim Leach had pressed for the hearings. He told NBC today the controversy won't jeopardize the Clinton presidency and it doesn't have to weaken it. Stock prices moved up today on Wall Street. The Dow gained almost 7 points to close at 3,869. This is NPR. Relatives of 11 Branch Davidians who were killed in the fire that ended the standoff last year are suing the government. They're asking for $675 million, dollars in damages from 19 present or former agents, including Stephen Higgins. He's the former director of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. The relatives claim the government violated the Davidians' constitutional rights, and this led to the deaths. The suit would force the government to prove the agents acted responsibly during the February raid on the Branch Davidian compound near Waco. Six Davidians are believed to have died in the raid, along with four federal agents. United Airlines is preparing for a cost-cutting move that could eliminate 2,700 jobs in the San Francisco area. The preparation comes while the carrier is negotiating with the Machinists Union on an employee buyout plan. Sally Isley, a member station KQED, reports from San Francisco.
The airline this week notified union workers it was beginning plans to contract out engine and heavy maintenance work currently done by its employees on its Boeing 727 and 737 jets. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, the move could mean the loss of close to 3,000 local jobs, another blow to the recession-plagued Bay Area economy. United says it could implement the plan in as little as 3 months' time. It's far from a certainty, however, as negotiations continue to progress on a $5 billion buyout plan by the airline's pilots and machinists unions. The plan would involve exchanging pay cuts for a majority stake in the country's largest airline. For National Public Radio, I'm Sally Isley in San Francisco.
Magic Johnson is returning to the L.A. Lakers basketball team. The star is now the team's new head coach. He retired from basketball after learning he'd contracted HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. Johnson's first game as head coach will be this Sunday. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Eugene Stein develops sitcoms for ABC Productions, where he's a vice president. And he's written for such shows as Cheers and Murphy Brown. His new novel is beyond the territory of sitcoms. It's told from the perspective of Bert, a teenager whose older brother Philip has undergone a psychotic break and become schizophrenic. Philip refuses to see a doctor because he believes he's perfecting his astral projection techniques and expects to soon be able to transcend his ego. Meanwhile, he's throwing out Bert's Bob Dylan records because he hears secret messages in them that are bad for people. While Bert copes with his brother's growing disorientation, Bert is confused by his own sexual feelings. He thinks he's probably gay. Here's a reading from the opening of the semi-autobiographical novel Straight Jacket and Tie.
Bert was 16 when his brother had his first psychotic break. Philip was a freshman at the State University in Stony Brook. At first, there had been a delicious sense of lightness. When Philip walked, he felt as though he were floating through clouds. But then background noises began growing louder and louder, obscuring the more important sounds in the foreground. Philip refused to return to school the following September, pleading for a year's grace to stay at home and decide who he was and what he wanted. His parents let him stay. Sometimes he felt reborn, renewed. Sometimes he felt touched by God. He was fascinated by out-of-body experiences, astral projection, and telepathy. If someone wanted to insert thoughts in you, they could do that, Philip told Bert. I don't think so, Phil, Bert said gently. They can. They can make you think a certain way. That's why homosexuals are so bad. They can put thoughts inside you. Philip despised homosexuals. The very idea of homosexuality sickened him. Every day, Philip listened to the radio, searching the static for a station that remained slightly out of reach. There are radio stations we don't even know about. The government has them, Philip assured his parents, Joseph and Evie. Sometimes you can just barely hear them. Maybe they were broadcast to make people gay. Philip laughed at the idea. He knew it sounded strange, but he believed it. At random moments, Philip would call out lines from songs, from television shows, from whatever. Bert would announce the sources, not because he wanted to, but because he felt it would put people at ease. He didn't know why he felt this overwhelming sense of responsibility, why it was his duty to make his brother's behavior palatable. Looking back, he found his efforts a little ludicrous. Waitress to Philip, what can I get you? Philip to waitress, you and I are of a kind. In a different reality, I could have called you friend. Bert, Star Trek, isn't it, Phil? Woman on a bus to Philip. We're moving so slowly. Philip to woman. Time is a jet plane. It moves too fast. Bert, that's Dylan, right? What song is it, Phil?
And that's Eugene Stein reading from his new novel, Straitjacket and Tie. Eugene, how closely is the character of Philip based on your brother?
Well, I think it's certainly the most autobiographical part of the book. My own brother is mentally ill, and so obviously I called upon my own experiences to write the relationship between Philip and Bert. But I felt free to lie, to distort, to change, to manipulate, anything I needed to do for the sake of the book.
Did your brother have paranoid delusions when you were growing up?
Pretty much about the same time as it happens in this book, when I was about 16, he became very ill. He was 19 or 20, and that's the age almost universally where schizophrenia strikes.
So what were the symptoms that you noticed first?
A withdrawal into himself, a sense that he was listening to kind of auditory hallucinations in his head, a general unkempt look that he had. I mean, he was obviously suffering a great deal. And, of course, our family felt powerless to help.
Did he try to pick up radio stations that didn't exist and find conspiracies in things?
Actually, I made that up for the book. He didn't have those delusions. He would become obsessed with particular figures, for instance, in rock and roll, not necessarily Bob Dylan. He would listen to music over and over again, searching, I think, songs for secret clues. But he didn't have the grand conspiracy theories that Philip has in the novel.
What kind of condition is he in now?
He actually lives in a halfway house in Manhattan. He doesn't need to be hospitalized. He kind of needs some supervision. But I'm pleased that he's taking his medicine and has some kind of life. I wish he were healthier. I wish he were better about taking his medicine. I wish he held a job, which I think to some degree he's able to, although he doesn't think he is. And I think we're waiting all... One out of every 100 people in the United States is schizophrenic, which is an astonishing statistic because you hear about the disease so rarely, really. And it's 1 out of 100 people in the United States, 1 out of 100 people in almost every country in the world. And I think we're all waiting for the next great wave of medication because we're starting to get some new drugs that are making some difference. And I think over the next 20 years, things will improve. I just hope it's sooner rather than later.
You print some of your brother's poems in your novel, as if the character in the novel had written them. And some of the poems really make no sense at all. Some of them have made up words and are really incoherent. And I wonder if your brother showed you those poems or if you found them yourself.
It's a combination. Some of them he showed me, some of them I found. They were reproduced in the book with his written permission. I actually find the poems quite beautiful. Even the ones that are perhaps incoherent, to me there are snatches of things I understand. They almost seem like surrealist poems. And it's obviously, the poetry is very deeply connected to his unconscious. He's able to draw from that. And then some of the poems aren't incoherent at all, and I think those are lovely as well.
Do you want to read one for us?
Oh, sure. I'll read On Turtle Island, which actually is a poem I wrote with my brother. I live a life of ease on Turtle Island. Got a girl I can please on Turtle Island. Eat some feta cheese on Turtle Island. No disease on Turtle Island. Study Portuguese on Turtle Island. Watch out for the bees on Turtle Island, where you get change back from your dollar. And that last line was written by my brother, and I find it so moving because where you get change back from your dollar, it relates so much to a person on a very limited income to whom change from a single dollar means a great deal.
How did you end up writing this poem together?
He had written some of it, and then I wrote some of it, and then we kind of passed it back and forth. It was at a time when he was relatively well. And we're continuing to do that. He still sends me some of his poetry, and some of it I love as it is complete, and some of it I work on. He's asked me to work on with him.
In your novel, the schizophrenic brother thinks that homosexuality is evil. And when the younger brother starts to realize that he is gay, at first it scares him and makes him think maybe homosexuality is an expression of his own madness.
There's a link in the character of Bert's mind, there's a link in his mind between gay desire and mental illness, and he likens them to a virus, a slow virus that's been in him, and what if now the virus is coming out and sickening him. I do know that gay sexuality for a teenager is terrifying very often. This certainly is not a society which welcomes it. So I think for someone who's grown up with a mentally ill brother, that experience makes him question his sanity.
Did you have an experience like that yourself?
I think at times I did. Not necessarily as specific as Bert's or as well thought out as Bert's. I think for me it was more general, and I had a sense that something was wrong, and I was worried, but I don't know that I put my finger on it in my own life as I have in the book.
Eugene Stein is my guest. His new novel is called Straitjacket and Tie. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. back with novelist and TV executive Eugene Stein. Now, you're vice president for comedy at ABC. Would you give us a brief...
At ABC Productions.
ABC Productions. So what does this mean? Give us a little job description of what...
Okay, well, all the networks are moving into program ownership. They want to own the programs that are on their air. And ABC Productions is the in-house unit at ABC, which our job is to create new shows that will be on the ABC schedule. So writers come to us with ideas. We try and sell these ideas to the network. We develop scripts. If the scripts turn out good, hopefully we get some pilots. And if the pilots come out good, hopefully we get some series on next fall's schedule.
So you said that the networks more and more want to own the programs that are on there. How is that different from what has been before?
Well, in the past, networks have largely paid what are called license fees to the studios, like a Warner Brothers or a Universal or a Paramount. And this license fee would give the network the right to air the show twice. But the studios own those shows, and after the show ran on a network, the studio could syndicate them in the syndication market where there are huge dollars to be had. And I think the networks, seeing the business contracting in some way, seeing cable eating up the share of the audience, the networks want to be in that program ownership business too.
So what are some of the shows you've brought on to ABC?
Well, I've only been at ABC Productions 8 months. We have three pilots going right now, so I'll be in a better position next fall to tell you which ones are coming.
Can you tell us anything about the pilots, or is that top secret?
No, it's not top secret. I'm pretty excited about some of them. One is with a black stand-up named Steve Harvey. I think he's a brilliant find, and it's a show about a single black father raising three sons. We have a show with another stand-up, Jack Gallagher, that's about a man at 40 becoming a father for the first time. And then we have a show at CBS, actually, about a couple whose children leave the nest and they're thrilled to be alone again, and then all three children move back home.
You know, the first two shows you mentioned are built around stand-ups, and I guess that must have a lot to do with the success of Seinfeld and Mad About You and Grace Under Fire.
And Roseanne.
And Roseanne,
Cosby
of course,
before it.
Yeah.
It's certainly been the most important trend in the last few years in network comedy development to build shows around stand-up. I have to say, I personally don't think it's the only way to develop, and I hope there will always be room for working with a writer who has a passion about a specific idea. But lately, so much of television has become cast-driven.
And what's behind that, do you think? Is it just the success of shows that have led to more and more shows like that?
Yes, I think there certainly is a copycat phenomenon where networks see what shows work, and the hits of the last few years are Roseanne and Home Improvement and Grace Under Fire and Seinfeld and Mad About You. It's hard to argue with that success. I think the other factor at work is how hard it is to cast pilots. And if you have if you build a show around a stand-up comic, then at least you already have the lead. You don't have to worry about casting that role.
What are some of the worst pitches you've ever heard for sitcoms?
Oh, I remember when I was at the network, there was a pitch about a black rabbi, and it was called Go Down Moses.
You're kidding.
No. And there was also a pitch about the domestic life of Abraham Lincoln in the 1850s. So it would be a pre-assassination sitcom. I'm afraid we passed on both of those.
Who was pitching these? Were these accomplished people?
Sometimes, yeah. I think one of them was. It's very hard coming up with a winning idea. That's why there are so few hits on the air.
Right. You are, I believe, 32 years old?
I'm now 33.
33. I don't know if you're seen as being young or average for a vice president in a production company, but I wonder if it ever feels uncomfortable to you when people who are older are pitching ideas to you and you know that, you know, their fate lies in your hands.
I have had that feeling, and I do feel uncomfortable. More so even is when you're developing a show with an established writer and you're giving notes to that writer, and I'm thinking to myself, who am I to give notes to this person who knows a lot more about TV than I do? But it's the nature of the job to try and work together, and so far I think I've been pretty successful at that. It's the part of the job I like best is working with the writers.
I just have one other question for you. Since you know, comedy is your business, does your brother who's schizophrenic have a sense of humor? Are you able to, can he get your jokes, and does he make jokes?
He is very funny, actually. Yes, he has never lost his sense of humor. And it was interesting to me, my grandmother died recently at 99, and she suffered from Alzheimer's the last few years, but she never lost her sense of humor. She was able to appreciate jokes and make jokes really until the very end. Even when everything else had left her mind, she still could appreciate comedy. And my brother's cognitive abilities have never really been affected. He's still extremely intelligent, and he has a wonderful sense of humor.
Was humor always important in your family?
Yeah, I think it was. My father was raised in an orphanage, and as a child, the orphanage would take the kids to see movies like twice a week, especially comedies. And I know he said that was the thing that got him through his childhood. And I think he kind of instilled that in us, an appreciation of comedy, an appreciation of film, certainly.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Eugene Stein is Vice President for Comedy at ABC Productions. His new novel is called Straitjacket and Tie. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing about a standoff that took place in the West Bank city of Hebron between gunmen believed to be members of the Muslim group Hamas and the Israeli army. We'll also be hearing about the opening of one of the bridges in Sarajevo, the Brotherhood and Unity Bridge that connects a government-controlled part of Sarajevo to a Serb-held part of the city, and more than 40 people were able to cross it for the first time in months and months today. Also, we'll be setting out the basics of Whitewater today, taking a little bit of time to spell out this story that some people think is a great distraction and others think is a major national scandal.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Rhythm, Country, and Blues is the title of a new album that pairs some of country music's biggest stars with veteran R&B singers in a frequently surprising series of duets. Rock critic Ken Tucker says that this novel project is a great idea that has yielded mixed results. Here's the first cut on the album.
That's Gladys Knight singing a nice, crisp version of Ain't Nothin' Like the Real Thing with country crooner Vince Gill. It's one of the more successful pairings on country rhythm and blues because Gill's plaintive voice adapts easily to the song's sensuous melody. As what amounts to being a backup singer for Gladys Knight, that Vince Gill is a real pip. At other times, however, the team-ups on this album are awkwardly off balance. Listen to the way Al Green begins a beautifully recorded new version of Funny How Time Slips Away, only to have Lyle Lovett join in what ends up sounding less like a duet than a rude interruption.
Well, hello there. My, it's been a long time. How am I doing? Well, I guess I'm doing fine. It's been so long now, and it seems like it was only yesterday.
Ain't it funny how time slips away?
Yeah. How's your new love? The problem is obvious here. However really cool the idea of this collaboration is, the Reverend Al meets Julia Roberts' big-haired husband, When it comes down to the singing, Lovett's scratchy hoarseness drags down Green's carefully thought-out passion. There are other such mismatches on country rhythm and blues. I'm going to spare you the selection that pairs the Pointer Sisters with Clint Black as they massacre Aretha Franklin's Chain of Fools. And while Marty Stewart and the Staple Singers might have found some common ground, it sure ain't on a version of the band's The Wait.
I pulled into Nazareth, was feeling about half-past dead. I just need some place where I can lay my head. Hey, mister, can you tell me where a man might find a bed? He just grinned, shook my hand, and know was all he said. Take a load off, Fanny. Take a load for free. Take a load off, Fanny. And you put the load right on me.
The idea behind country rhythm and blues is a laudable one. At a time when black and white artists are routinely segregated on commercial radio by rigid formats, it's always good to be reminded that people like and are influenced by all sorts of music. But too much of the countryside of country rhythm and blues is based on popularity, not talent. I mean, why inflict the great Aaron Neville with an overrated Linda Ronstadt impersonator like Trisha Yearwood, other than the fact that Yearwood is the country industry's hype of the moment? And Patti LaBelle must have been wondering who the heck this bellowing Yahoo Travis Tritt was as they made their way through Sam and Dave's When Something Is Wrong With My Baby. But on the other hand, who'd have thought that Little Richard and Tanya Tucker would have such good, raucous fun singing Richard's old rocker Something Else? Country rhythm and blues is a stunt that works best when it springs surprises rather than calculating demographics and market shares.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Devin Reif and Ann Neville are our interns. Roberta Shirok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Hey, look here. Just wait and see. Something else.
Ooh, here's something else. Oh, look here. What's all this? I never thought I'd do this before. But here I am, I'm knocking on his door. My car's out front, and it's all mine. Just a 41 Ford, not a 59. I got that boy, and I'm thinking to myself, he's sure a fine looking man. Wow, he's something else.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, tracking down the story of Schindler's List, we talk with Australian writer Thomas Keneally, who wrote the best-selling novel that the movie was based on. And Nigerian writer Wole Soyinka joins us. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.